You're listening to episode 199 of Women Worldwide. Maybe you've heard of ad tech and fintech, but now there's ed tech, where learning, data, and technology all go together. Stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning into another episode of Women Worldwide. Just want to thank you. Thank you so much, because Women Worldwide is growing and the incredible stories of our guests are being amplified. And you know, when you're sharing, you're really helping to raise their voices. You're creating impact and making a difference with all the people who come on this show. So thank you. Thank you for the support. We really appreciate it. All right, let's get right to today's topic. It's ed tech. That's right, education and technology fusing together, and also the power of data and data visualization. We use data every day, whether we know it or not, in the classroom, on social media, in business. It is a big part of our world. And I've got a guest today who has focused her career on ed tech and data visualization. Joining me is Dr. Kristen Sosulski, who is the author of the book, Data Visualization Made Simple, Insights into Becoming Visual. And it's something that we all need. Kristen is a data visualization professor, and she's a speaker. As a leading expert on data visualization, Kristen regularly consults. She delivers seminars and leads workshops on data visualization techniques and best practices. Kristen, it's great to have you on my show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Deirdre. It's really a pleasure and honor to be here.
Well, we're honored to have you here. And oh gosh, if anybody can break down data visualization and make it simple, that would be absolutely wonderful for us. So I'd like to start a little bit with how you got into what you're doing. You didn't have a background in education, but you love to code. I know I read that. So how did you find your way to teaching and ed tech?
So my journey was actually pretty straightforward. So I went to business school undergrad, and that's where I learned how to code. And it was during the .com era. And so I was an information systems major. And then I decided to that I really wanted to further my education, but I wasn't sure where. And I landed this like amazing job at Columbia University. And I thought at the same time, I could kind of go to grad school. So I thought it was a great idea to work at this new media lab that was focused on using technology to help students learn. And that just seemed amazing. It was such a different way to look at technology. I was always looking at it from the business viewpoint in my undergrad education. And so this really opened my eyes to the world of learning sciences, and specifically this field of educational technology, which is the study and practice of facilitating learning and improving learner performance by using technological resources like appropriately. So it was all about the purposeful use of technology. And so I was, it was a center that was led by this infamous professor at Teachers College, Columbia University, Frank Moretti. And he was really an inspiration and a leader for how we can create immersive educational experiences with the use of technology. So that's how I became interested in the field. And then I started my my degree at Columbia University. And I went for my first master's in instructional technology. And then it became a second master's, and then it became a doctorate. And so I just got hooked. And I knew the technology. And so I was really seeking to learn what's called the learning science behind different design decisions that you make when you design immersive digital experiences. And so how do we design to, say, reduce cognitive load? How do we design to encourage and build community, facilitate interaction, to allow for student reflection? And it's all about what the learner is doing. It's not about creating things that look cool, although we did that. Yeah. I always did that because that's a big part of the sell for this field of educational technology, is that you need to design in a way to have a usable, user-friendly environment to allow for the proper navigation of the educational resources, to allow for that learning to happen. And so you construct that, and you construct that through a variety of design decisions that you make with the use of technology. And so I'll just pause there, but that's how I got into this area of educational technology and learning science.
Well, I am all for improving learning performance and having an immersive experience. How long did it take from the two master's degrees and then the doctorate? How many years is that?
Oh, it took way too long.
That's a lengthy period, but you must have loved it.
I really did. And I was working at the same time, so I got to put those learning theories into practice, during the day, and then taking classes, at night. I was able to refine my understanding of those theories and really dig in. And so it was a really great time. It took about 9 years for me to have this experience and to complete my work and my research in the field of learning science and educational technology.
Well, great job, Kristen. 9 years. That's wonderful. Maybe, was there anything, as you were going through this and pursuing your career, any skills perhaps that you feel are really important if you're going into ed tech?
Absolutely. One of the things that one has to realize is that not everybody really understands what educational technology is. And so being able to clearly define it as is going to be critical in this field. So it's not about designing things to make life more efficient for you or to just put stuff online. And so the whole goal there is, you might have a challenge that you face in your classroom, whether it be online or on site. And how do you think about how to redesign that experience to add those components that you feel like will best facilitate learning? For instance, is it important for you to bring experts into the classroom and to have a diverse perspective on a particular theory or concept, for instance? Is it important for students to take pause and actually practice what it is that you are the concepts you're introducing to them? And how can you explain that whole process to someone that it might be pretty new for? And so one of the skills that I learned in this is how to make your ideas concrete, how to take what's in your mind. Yes, as an idea, working with a colleague, it might be, a professor, who teaches film, for instance, and how to actually make your ideas concrete, that, that this type of design could facilitate this type of learning that you're trying to achieve. And just talking about it makes it pretty gray. And so the idea is, how do we create wireframes and prototypes to really show the different approaches that one could take? And that's one of the best skills that an educational technologist needs. Another one is project management. And so you're usually collaborating with a colleague to develop these immersive, you know, digital environments, and they have to get done. So you might be working with coders and web designers and yes. the content experts. And how do you make sure everything gets done on time and that it's tested for quality, it's tested for accessibility, and all these different things that you need to think about when you're managing a project. And, you know, as faculty, and as a professor myself, you know, my time isn't unlimited. So if I'm engaging with somebody in this field to build a cool project for my students, it's not like I have unlimited time. And so that you need to have great management skills if you're taking on a role in this area. Another thing is really the ability to communicate the rationale for why certain design decisions have been made and root that in the theory and practices of learning science. So, you know, the way that we arrange our screens, the way that we navigate through a digital experience, all those things can't just be haphazard. They come from a body of knowledge and research that we use to inform our practices and then test that to further refine those initial understandings.
Right. I mean, these skills, even just right down to the first one you said, how to make ideas concrete, it's harder than it sounds. You know, like these skills have to be honed, definitely. What about, let's pivot over to your book, because your book brings to life a lot of what you're doing, the data visualization. Can anybody understand? I mean, it is data visualization made simple. So can anybody understand this subject?
Absolutely. So it's really a book for anyone, and it's a subject for anyone, from, you know, creatives to data wonks is the way I've been pitching it. And really, like, for people who are new to working with data, I have a whole chapter explaining preliminary, like, data exploration methods and data analysis methods and how to work with data. This is really at the core of being able to visualize it. If you can't get your data in the right form, or if you don't know what your data means in real life and you can't understand what those rows and columns mean, that will be a problem. And so there's a chapter that introduces you to these fundamental concepts. And this chapter can be, you know, definitely skimmed by those data wonks, those people that are so familiar with working with data, they do it on a daily basis, but maybe need help in communicating the insights that they find and not just speaking in statistical terms that, you know, only a small group of colleagues perhaps can understand, but be able to reach a broader audience with their, you know, with their brilliant ideas that they've, you know, mined and analyzed from the data and the research and the work that they've been doing. And so there's a whole chapter on presentation, on designing for your audience, chapter on actually refining your data graphics. And so to reduce things like cognitive load, like I mentioned before, not to overwhelm one's working memory, which is extremely limited, and how to connect with our audience and ensure that they are kind of connected with us and they actually remember. So we really focus on retention in the book a little bit. They actually remember the key takeaways from our data presentations.
Is there one big takeaway or a couple of takeaways that you want readers to get out of your book?
So a huge one is don't make your audience work too hard. And don't show them a graphic that they've never seen before in terms of the format, like a parallel coordinates or a violin chart or a tree map. If they're not familiar with these types of displays, they're not going to be able to glean the insights that you want to communicate. If your font is too small or if your message is unclear, you're really having the audience kind of struggle with that. And
right. It might look cool, but you don't want them to struggle.
Yeah, they might be impressed because they're like, oh, wait, I should understand that. But we really want to be on the same level with our audience. And our goal is to make sure that they walk away remembering that key takeaway or that key insight. And I call that the party favor or the wedding favor. So, you know, when you go to a wedding, you usually get a little trinket at the end. And yes. The idea here is to have something, that memento that you remember when you leave that presentation, that data presentation, or read that report. You want something to stick with your audience. And if you're not being considerate of them, the probability of that happening is going to be much lower.
Yeah, I can imagine. So how do executives or people in business benefit from data visualization? Can you just give some easy examples?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that we hear a lot in terms of data visualization is its ability to help you tell stories. And while I totally agree and support that, I like to break that down into some key basic activities, like you were mentioning, Deirdre. Like, first, it's a tool to communicate. And so you can lead using data visualization to show cause and effect, to show an illustrative process, to simply clarify an idea using data as evidence. And what would someone rather see? Kind of like a table of numbers or, you know, a graph that clearly reveals the trend and puts it in context with what happened yesterday and what may happen tomorrow. Though that is just so extremely powerful. And it allows everybody to get on the same page. So you're able to like democratize the access to the insights by having a medium that is easy to interpret. And then you can start building a culture around the use of visual data graphics to communicate what people are finding in their work, insights, messages that they want to communicate. So this is one way that managers can use it. Another way is just, you know, in the data exploration process, it's to transform data into information. So rather than just a table of numbers and you're not really sure what the insights are, why don't you show me what happened yesterday and present that historical report in terms of a trend? And then categorize that by, you know, product sales over that period of time. And then you can keep building on that that type of informational display that allows you to build displays to show you what's happening in the present. And that's where we use dashboards. So dashboards are these displays that are on your desktop that might be web or cloud based, right? That tell you what's happening now. So anybody who's on social media like knows exactly what I mean. Like you can see the impact of like a tweet that you made, right? Or you can see the analytics for a post that you made on LinkedIn, right? Those things in some ways are mini, mini dashboards, giving you a clear insight of an action that you've taken and what the result was. And so imagine if we can do that all around our different business units. And again, that's transforming data to information and then information that can be acted on in the present. A lot of times what we do is we are reporting on the past and we think about data in the past, but we can also be showing what's happening in the present. And then also, as we get more sophisticated, be able to show predictions of what we think may happen in the future.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's amazing. I can see what you're saying about how you would look at the past, but really the gem, the real nugget is the prediction and the future, right? Predictive analytics, data visualization. Kristen, just, you know, you mentioned build a culture. So it's not just using data and data visualization as a part of your culture, but it's really getting to that simplifying, clarifying, getting the culture to be explorative around data, to be able to communicate. Is that what you meant by building a culture?
Absolutely. And I mean, ways to do this is like you need to have a data practice within your organization. So understanding the everybody needs to have an understanding of the data they have, need to be able to have a voice box to identify the data they think they will need to do their jobs in a data-driven way. And be able to have a great relationship with their IT team to be able to extract that data, and then also have the opportunity to collect new data. And then guidelines around all of that, ethical guidelines for use and sharing and all of that. And then decide who has access to it in terms of, you know, throughout an organization, and be able to build this culture of use by designating champions with your organization who actually model these practices, which is actually an educational theory that I bring into this, right? And so if you're able to kind of model the types of behaviors that you want to see in an organization, that's the best way to build this culture of use. It's one thing to tell, it's another thing to demonstrate, right? And to show how it can be used and the impact of it. And so everything from any kind of queries that you answer those queries using data as evidence, and that evidence is presented as a visual. You report on performance using visuals that are driven by data. And all of this allows for just like an ease of communication. And always, you know, in this culture building, understanding that people are at different levels of understanding. And the subtitle of my book, Insights into Becoming Visual, it's all about this, that what you do today will look very different tomorrow. You hate the graph that you created yesterday. You're going to refine it today, and now you're going to love it, and then you'll hate it tomorrow. So the idea is that this is a process. And so offering training in organizations around visualization is going to be super important, and training on visualization and working with data and best ways to communicate using this medium is going to be super important and effective.
Well, I definitely heard a strong point that you made there, and it sounds like you can't build a culture of data and data visualization in a vacuum. It's about many others in the organizations. You also said champions. And that just begs a really quick question. How do you find these data champions? Or do they come forward and raise their hands and say, I'm all about data. You know, I want to advocate on this. I think you mentioned data practice in the organization.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Absolutely. You know, I frequently speak at, you know, a variety of different, you know, these New York City meetups. One on like women in machine learning, another one on specifically data visualization. And what I hear a lot is like, there's a lot of lone wolves there. There are people that want to do these things, but they're few and far between. And so if you recognize that as a manager or executive, somebody in a position that you can help elevate their impact of this work, that's going to be beneficial for you and the organization. And so I always like to take advantage of the enthusiasm of my colleagues. And if they're interested in something, I always kind of let them run with it a little bit and to give them a little space and collaborate with them for saying like, hey, how could we get others to be interested in these same things? Could you make a presentation? Give them the floor for a moment. And I think that that takes a lot of confidence as a manager to be able to do that. But it's also a learning experience. And if you think of your organization as a learning organization, this will be something that will come pretty natural to you.
Absolutely. And then it just grows. Kristen, I'm going to ask you just to hold your thoughts for a moment, because I would like to just spend a little time talking about our sponsor, PrepDish. So have you ever heard of PrepDish?
I have not, but I want to.
Okay, cool. Well, I am going to share with you and the Women Worldwide listeners. PrepDish is a subscription-based meal planning service, and it really saves you time, and it helps you to make your dinners much more delicious. At least that's what I've experienced. For me, PrepDish took away a really, just this uncomfortable question at the dinner hour. What are we having for dinner? It would be 5 o'clock, and I would really not know. So, and then when you would say what you were having, your family would then turn around and say something like, oh gosh, not again. So you're probably wondering, well, how does this service work? And I'll tell you, every week you receive a weekly meal plan. You get a grocery list. So you know upfront all the ingredients, and you're going to be prepping in advance for the week. You go and you do your shopping. You set aside 2-3 hours. I'm closer to the 3 hour side, just to prepare everything. And then, you know, you pick your day. So I prep on a Sunday, sets me up for the entire week. If you, two dishes that are faves of mine, if you love a good frittata, there's a sweet potato frittata, and there's also a mushroom and kale frittata cups, which is on a super fast menu. It's great. But you can check out the different recipes. I'm sure there's ones that you will find to be really appealing. And if you think about it, your meals just got super easy. Mine did, because I'm saving time, and time is super precious. It's a precious commodity. I know you know what I'm talking about. And with a crazy schedule just like you, I let PrepDish do the planning for me. But the best part is that PrepDish has a fantastic offer for Women Worldwide listeners. You can go to PrepDish.com/worldwide and get 2 weeks of PrepDish for free. So try it. I know you're going to love it. PrepDish.com/worldwide. And I'm just really excited for listeners to try PrepDish because it's so easy. Okay, Kristen, let's dive right back into our discussion. We were just talking about data in the organization, how you can create this data practice, have these champions, you're not working in a vacuum. I guess, you know, with all the great ways that data and data visualization are being used, I guess I wanted to ask a little bit maybe about the challenges. So have you faced any challenges getting people to understand or just challenges in ed tech in general?
Well, absolutely. We all face challenges and some more than others, and I'm probably on that side of things. But one challenge that I face that I've learned to address is the ability to slow down. And we're in a culture, we're always trying to, you know, pitch our idea, communicate something to achieve some objective. And sometimes we rush and we don't give the attention that's needed to the task at hand. And this is something that is one of the biggest challenges. A lot of times we want to immediately see the results of our effort and test it out and get that data and visualize it and then move on to the next task. And one of the things that's been helpful with that challenge is building into my process the ability to show my work to others at a stage where it's not perfect, but to have the confidence to share my work and to get feedback and to accept that feedback and criticism and use that as an input to refine what I do. That's like one of the biggest things that has been a challenge for me, in which that I've been able to overcome. But this idea of sharing work and getting feedback and exposing yourself and your imperfections and realizing that you might create a data graphic that looks beautiful and then you show it to somebody, they don't know what it means. But that's much lower risk than doing that, you know, when you're on the grand stage in front of hundreds of people. And so building in that modesty, building in that ability to receive feedback and incorporate that into your work and actually really improves your practice. And this is also the same with ed tech. A lot of times we have these collaborations where we build these great educational interventions. But an external person could have given some feedback at, say, the design stage. And being able to just build that into your process, it takes time and it forces you to slow down a little bit and reflect and to build that, build a reflective practice, whether it's in ed tech or visualizing data.
Well, I can see that definitely being a challenge because we're all in a data-driven world and everything is real-time, fast-paced, capture, filter, organize, create what you need to create and use it to improve what you're doing. So it is super fast-paced, no matter what environment you're in. But what I'm hearing you say is that you should never be too busy for feedback. And building that in, because after all, the data, what you're capturing and visualizing is for either the organization or for customers or some audience. And if that audience is sharing, you certainly want to take advantage of that rich perspective and have that critique. So I think that's really interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Are there any skills? You mentioned some of the skills before. Do you find yourself having to improve upon certain skills or needing to learn new things as you go along? Because learning is so important.
Oh my gosh, all the time. So the first area where I'm always learning is with the technology, right? That's always changing. And so there are new versions of software, there are new packages in, you know, in R or Python that one has to learn that allow you to do this or that, or to create this specific type of graphic that you've never done before. And so absolutely. And so there's always like a lot of great challenges, and those I love. I mean, that's just, you know, that's what I do from like 10 to 12 at night. It's always learning.
When you say R and Python, are you coding?
Absolutely.
Is this all? Okay. And is that one of the skills? Do you have, in order to be either an ed tech or really have a fine grasp and a true understanding of data visualization, you have to learn to code?
Not necessarily. It's really great to have a foundation in understanding how computers work and how to program them. That's fundamental. It helps you with skills like logic and how to build experiences that might be adaptive, and that might be decision based, and understanding the certain rules in which that you can employ in your design, based on the capabilities of the technology. A lot of this has to do with logic. We've all heard of like if else logic, or if then logic. So it's really great for that. It's also great for understanding just various types of data. So like the second or third chapter of any programming book will talk about something called data types. So I have data that might be an integer. I have a data that might be a string. And the ways in which we can manipulate and use this data is very different. For instance, we can do math with integers. We can't do math with strings. An example of a string would be like our first names, right? And so we're not going to do math on that unless we're counting the number of letters in our name. And why would we do that?
Exactly.
So it helps you with those fundamentals, but it's not necessary. It's just helpful. And I code a lot because I like to incorporate different types of data graphics into my work and into my exploratory analysis of data. And that proves impossible with some of the tools that are available that are just kind of point and click. And so when you're dealing with a lot of data with many variables, we call that multivariate data. And we usually want to create multivariate displays, things like radar charts or parallel coordinate charts or scatter plot matrices, all these things that are just very, very simple to do in a few lines of code that would take a very long time to do in a tool like Tableau, for instance. And it may not be worth the payoff. And so if you're adaptable to learning some coding, it would definitely help you in the data exploration phase. It also is really helpful for data modeling. And so you mentioned something like predictive analytics and predictive modeling and machine learning. This is a completely new area that has been popularized. It's been around forever, I should say, but it's been very in the culture today around business analytics and data analytics has really exploded. And it's an opportunity to join a new field of data scientists and learning scientists to be able to model data and develop interesting ways to learn from that and to improve our practices and our business.
So you just mentioned the data scientist and the learning scientist. So I know companies are hiring data scientists. Are they hiring learning scientists? Are they similar?
So, for instance, like a learning scientist, like one of the activities may be to focus on an area called learning analytics. And learning analytics has to do with those particular data that are collected during the learning process in digital environments. Right. And so it's anything from like, did they click on this first or that first, to how did they, transfer this knowledge that they learned 10 minutes ago to, this particular activity that they engaged in 2 days later. And those types of analytics can help and provide insights into educators to how students are learning, how they're progressing in their knowledge building activities. So that's one area. And data science, this is a data scientist is more of a generic term. And you'll find data scientists in education. You'll also find them, you know, in business, in community organizations. You'll find them all over.
Well, that is fascinating. on the note of learning, this might be a tough question, but what do you think you've learned about yourself that was almost unexpected from the time that you started until now? Anything stand out?
Absolutely. So it's a little embarrassing, but what I learned is how I learn. And I learned this probably when I was about 21. I really understood the best way for me to confidently say that I know something. And for me, it wasn't reading a textbook or reading an article or even necessarily writing. It was the process of actually being able to teach something that taught me how I learn. It was this internalization of not only the content and the knowledge attributes, but then being able to distill it and simplify it for an audience. And that was like so extremely powerful. And so now, knowing that this is how I learn, it takes me a really long time to learn something. And I always joke with myself that like, the only way that I'll really have command of a foreign language is if I teach it. Because then I will have the pressure to be able to have to really work with learners to help them understand it. And that means that I need to have a solid understanding that. And to do that, I need to immerse myself in it. And I think these days, you know, learners like tend to be like very overconfident. If they read it on Wikipedia, like, you know, we know the basic foundation. And I think Wikipedia actually works best for experts, rather than novices. I think that, there needs to be a better understanding that the development of expertise takes quite a number of years, you know, 10 or plus years to develop real expertise, and allowing yourself that time to learn something and to learn it really well. Maybe not 10 years for everything, but if you're learning a new field, you know, not necessarily, you're not going to be an expert right away. You might be a leader in the beginning and leading the pack. But to constantly refine your practice and to continue to keep that leadership position takes time, and it takes study and reflection. And, those are some things that I learned.
Well, you really have to dive in. And you just mentioned the reflection, which is you need the feedback, slowing down that challenge that we talked about.
Yeah.
And being able to reflect on what you've done. Something tells me that, you know, when we talk about the way people learn, there's audio, there's visual, maybe you're reading. Something tells me you're a visual type of learner.
Yeah. I mean, as humans, we're like all multimodal. You know, there's like a lot of those theories around that have actually been debunked. And what we want to do is we really want to engage all the senses, right? We don't want to overload our auditory channel or a visual channel. We want to have a balance of load in that. And this way it allows us to like more efficiently process information. And the visuals can certainly help, but they can be hindered if you're distracting, you know, the audience or the learner at the time in which they're shown the visual. Are you giving them enough time to actually process and study it? So just because a visual is there doesn't mean that it's effective or you're using it in the most effective way. And this is like kind of like where we started today about like kind of being kind to your audience and recognizing that our audience, you know, they're humans and we have limited capacity in terms of our working memory and how much information we can process. And so allowing for the time and the slowing down, even in the delivery of your data presentations, is going to be super critical. To ensure that they retain your message in the way that was intended.
These are all great points. So Kristen, tell me, what keeps you grounded and focused and just moving forward every single day?
Pengos, my son.
So nice.
He's 2 years old and he is learning at such a fast rate that I can't even believe. And I feel like I have to catch up to him. He knows the name of almost every dinosaur. So
he's like technology, always changing. They grow so quickly. You just, you blink and you miss something.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the things that definitely keep me grounded is allowed me to actually actually be more efficient with my time, right? So I don't have as much time to dedicate to my practice and my work, obviously, right? With a 2-year-old at home. And so, but what's helped me reduce stress and all of that is actually just doing a lot of planning around, you know, when I'm home, I'm home and I'm a mom. And after he goes to bed, then, you know, then I'm something else. But that's been really helpful to me to know that when I come home, it's not about work or other things. It's really about being a mom.
I think that's so great. I mean, it is very, very difficult sometimes to separate what you're doing in your day and how much you're giving and the energy. And then to go home, you have to turn that off. You have to turn the technology off and the focus. I just read somewhere that even as much as 15 minutes of straight focus with your children will help them to succeed when they're older. So that time with them is really important. Go back to stress. You know, you mentioned the word mm-hmm. stress. How do you actually handle stress? I mean, I know you said that you're a planner and that you definitely, when you're home and you're a mom. But even the stress of your job, being an ed tech and the challenges, any tips?
Sure. What I like to do, is to make sure I have, you know, obviously like outlets. And so, exercise for me is really a good one. tennis and running. And if it's a really bad day, I do a bar class, which, you know, are pretty horrific.
Yes. So I've heard, I've never done one.
But, you know, one thing that, you know, there's a lot of tough problems that arise, in higher education and, in every context. And what I find that helps me with that is actually just bringing my team together and talking it through. And I realize that communication and a little FaceTime with everyone is a really great way to mitigate the stress and, make yourself feel supported and to support those around you. And I just feel like building a supportive culture is nice. So when you do feel stressed, I can ask one of my colleagues to join me for coffee and talk through some of these things. And so I think having a support network is really important, whether you find that with your team or other colleagues.
Yeah, that is a big stress buster. Do you have any, because we talked about time, I think of efficiency and tools that we can use. Do you have any, tech resources, tools that help you to be more efficient?
I use a variety of different tools and tactics. One of the things that, I do a lot is, I use my Google Calendar and I set up different calendars for different types of tasks and, use that as a great way to kind of plan. There's also like the tasks that are available in Google Calendar where you can create like a quick checklist and have some reminders. I love that. I use that all the time. And I always keep like a series of like floating agendas around for each type of meeting. And so there's always a continuity for each meeting that I have. And I have like 5 or 6 different types of meetings a week. And having that continuity just helps reduce my overall load. Oh, what happened last week? What were those action items? Did I do them? And that's just really, really helped me. And then I share those different agendas with my team and resources. And so everybody's always on the same page. We're not trying to kind of like remember what happened at the last meeting. And these are just simple management things. And at times, I recognize that, I don't have to do everything myself. And like I said, I'm kind of a doer and that's really how I learn. But being able to, share in a variety of leadership responsibilities, has also been very helpful to me.
Right. Share, collaborate, this is all very helpful. Just a little parting advice. Maybe you could give some advice to all of the listeners out there about embracing data, analytics, and visualization. What would you say to them?
I would say do it. there is a huge opportunity in organizations right now to lead and to lead with data visualization, right? The communication and distillation of insights, of findings, of predictions, of measures of productivity can be shown visually across an organization. And like I said, there's very few people in organizations that are doing this as a whole. And so being able to take on a position like that and lead, I think there's a real opportunity. And there's a real opportunity to be reflective in our own practices about analytics. And so understanding, how to use data to inform decision making, how to show cause and effect, how to build the case for, you know, the business case for a new opportunity. And we're all used to kind of using data, but thinking about it as evidence and as a way to persuade and also engage, is going to be super valuable in any discipline from, you know, education to the business world.
Absolutely. I love it. Do it. Take it on, lead, be reflective, and use data visualization in decision making. Great advice, Kristen. Okay, last question, super easy.
Okay.
Where can people find out more about you and your book?
So you can find more about me on my website, kristensosulski.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. My handle is SOSULSKI. I have the same handle for LinkedIn, Pinterest, and so on. So you can find me on any of the social channels. And you can always feel free to email me. I have a simple email address. It's ks123@nyu.edu.
That is super easy. It's nice when you make it simple for people. Kristen, thank you so much. You know, hearing the name of your book, making data visualization simple. I wasn't so sure, but want to thank you for making it simple and for enlightening us on your work. We really appreciate your time and all of your advice. So thank you.
Thank you, Deirdre.
You're welcome. I'd also like to thank PrepDish for sponsoring this episode of Women Worldwide. Be sure to check out their 2-week free trial at prepdish.com/worldwide. And lastly, thank you, all of you listeners out there, for tuning into the show, for giving your feedback. We always want to hear from you. So go rate us on iTunes. Give us a shout out on Facebook and Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Okay, friends, until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered.